Nothing's well, Dennis thought miserably. Not one single thing. He drew his thin coat more tightly around him and began the long job of waiting down the moon. Eventually it left the sky, and Dennis knew he had to move. Time had grown short. He stood, said a brief prayer to his gods, and began to walk across the open space as rapidly as he could, expecting a hail of "Who goes there?" from the castle walls at every moment. The hail did not come. The clouds had thickened across the night sky. All below the castle wall was one dark shadow. In less than 10 minutes, Dennis had reached the edge of the moat. He sat on its low bank, the snow crunching under his bottom, and took the snowshoes off. He slid down onto the moat itself, which was frozen and covered with more snow. Dennis's thundering heart slowed down. He was in the shadow of the bulking castle wall now, and would not be seen unless a sentry happened to look straight down, and most probably not even then. Dennis was careful not to go all the way across the moat, not yet, because the ice close to the castle wall would be rotted and thin. He knew why this was so. The reason for the thin ice and the unpleasant smell here and the mossy wetness on the huge stones of the outer wall was his hope of entering the castle secretly. He moved carefully to the left, ears listening for the noise of running water. At last he heard it and looked up. There, at eye height, was a round black hole in the solid castle wall. Fluid ran from it in listless streams. It was a sewer outflow pipe.
"Now for it,"
Dennis muttered. He drew back 5 paces, ran, and leaped. As he did, he felt the ice, rotted by the constant outflow of warm waste from the pipe, give under his feet. Then he was clinging to the mossy lip of the pipe. It was slick, and he had to clutch hard to keep from falling. He pulled himself up, digging for purchase with his feet, and finally yanked himself inside. He paused for a moment, trying to get his breath back, then began to crawl along the pipe, which slanted steadily upward. He and several of his playmates had found these pipes when they were children and had been quickly warned off by their parents, partly because they might become lost, mostly because of the sewer rats. Still, Dennis thought he knew where he would come out. An hour later, in a deserted corridor of the castle's east wing, a sewer grating moved, was still, then moved again. It was shoved partway aside, and a few moments later a very dirty and very smelly butler named Dennis pulled himself out of a hole in the floor and lay panting on the cold cobbles. He could have used a longer rest, but someone might come along, even at this unearthly hour. So he replaced the grating and looked around. He did not recognize the hallway at once, but this in no way upset him. He started down it toward the T-intersection at the far end. At least, he reflected, there had been no rats in the warren of sewer pipes below the castle. That had been a great relief. He had been prepared for them, not just because of the gruesome tales his Da had told him, but because there had been rats on a few occasions when he and his mates had ventured with fearful screeches of laughter down into the pipes as children. The rats had been part of the scary dare-you adventure of it. Probably there were just a few mice, and your memories exaggerated them into rats, Dennis thought now. This was not the truth, but Dennis would never know it. His memory of the rats in the sewers was a true one. The pipes had been infested with great, disease-bearing rodents since time out of mind. It had only been for the last 5 years that they had ceased to teem in the sewers. They had been wiped out by flag. The magician had rid himself of both a piece of stone and his own dagger by means of a sewer grating similar to the one from which Dennis had emerged on this early Sunday morning. He had rid himself of them, of course, because there were a few flecks of the deadly green dragon sand on each. The fumes from those few grains had killed the rats, burning many of them alive even as they paddled through the scummy water in the pipes, suffocating all the others before they could flee. 5 years later, the rats had still not come back, although most of the poisonous fumes had dissipated. Most, but not all. If Dennis had entered one of the sewer pipes a bit closer to Flagg's apartments, he might well have died himself. Perhaps it was luck that saved him, or fate, or those gods he prayed to. I'll not take a stand on the matter. I tell tales, not tea leaves, and on the subject of Dennis's survival, I leave you to your own conclusions. '93. He reached the junction, peered around the corner, and saw a sleepy young guard of the watch passing farther up the way. Dennis pulled back. His heart was thumping hard again, but he was satisfied. He knew where he was. When he looked back, the guard was gone. Dennis moved quickly, up this corridor, down that flight of stairs across t'other gallery. He moved with speedy sure-footedness, for he had spent his whole life in the castle. He knew it well enough, certainly, to find his way from the east wing, where he had come out of the sewers, to the lower west wing, where the napkins were stored. But because he dared not be seen, not by anyone, Dennis went by the most obscure corridors he knew, and at the sound of every footfall, either real or imagined, and I do think quite a few of them were imagined, he withdrew into the nearest cranny or niche. In the end, it took him over an hour. He thought he had never been so hungry in his life.
"Never mind your cussed belly now, Dennis. Take care of your master first, your belly later."
He was standing far back in a shadowy doorway. Faintly, he heard the crier call 4 o'clock. He was about to move forward when slow, echoing footfalls came down the hallway, a clank of steel and scabbard, a creak of leather leggings. Dennis pushed himself farther back into the shadows, sweating. A guard of the watch paused just in front of the thinly shadowed doorway where Dennis hid. The fellow stood for a moment rooting in his nose with his little finger, and then leaned over to blow a stream of snot between his knuckles. Dennis could have reached out and touched him, had felt certain that any moment the guard would turn. His eyes would widen, he would draw his short sword, and that would be the end of Dennis, son of Brandon.
"Please," Dennis's frozen mind whispered, "please, oh please."
He could smell the guard, could smell the old wine and burned meat on his breath and the sour sweat coming out of his skin. The guard started to move on. Dennis began to relax. Then the guard stopped and began rooting in his nose again. Dennis could have screamed.
"I have a girl name of Marchi Marchimelda,"
the guard began to sing in a low-pitched, droning voice, rooting in his nose all the while. He produced a large green something, examined it thoughtfully, and flicked it onto the wall.
Splat! "She's got a sister named Esmeralda, a would sail the seven seas just to kiss her dimply knees. Tutty sing, tay sing, tea, pass me a bucket of wine."
Something exceedingly horrible was now happening to Dennis. His nose had begun to itch and tickle in a way which was unmistakable. Very soon he would sneeze.
"Go!"
he screamed in his mind.
"Oh, why don't you go, you stupid fool?"
But the guard seemed to have no intentions of going. He had apparently struck a rich load up in the left nostril, and he meant to mine it.
"I have a girl name of Darche, Darche Darla. She's got a sister named Red-Headed Carla. I would take 1,000 sips from her pretty, pretty lips. Tutty sing tay, sing tea, and pass me a bucket of wine."
"I'll hit you over the head with a bucket of wine, you fool," Dennis thought. "Move on!"
The itch in his nose grew steadily worse, but he did not dare even touch it for fear the guard would see the movement from the corner of his eye. The guard frowned, bent over, blew his nose between his knuckles again, and finally moved on, still singing his droning song. He was barely out of sight before Dennis threw his arm over his own nose and mouth and sneezed into the crook of his elbow. He waited for the clash of metal as the guard drew his sword and whirled back, but the fellow was half asleep and still half drunk from whatever party he had been at before his tour of duty commenced. Once, Dennis knew, such a slovenly creature would have been quickly discovered and sent to the farthest reaches of the kingdom, but times had changed. There was a click of a latch, the squeak of hinges as a door was drawn open, and then it boomed closed, cutting off the guard's song just as he reached the chorus again. Dennis sagged back in his niche for a moment, eyes closed, cheeks and forehead on fire, his feet twin blocks of ice.
"For a few minutes there I didn't think of my belly at all," he thought,
and then he had to slam both hands over his mouth to stifle a giggle. He peeked out of his hiding place, saw no one about, and moved to a doorway down the corridor and on his right. He knew this doorway very well, although the empty rocker and needlework case outside it were new to him. The door led to the room where all of those napkins had been stored since the time of Kyla the Good. It had never been locked before, and was not now. Old napkins were apparently not considered worth locking up. He peered inside, hoping that his answer to Pena's key question still held true. Standing there in the road on that bright morning 5 days ago, Pena had asked him this. "Do you know when they take fresh stores of napkins to the needle, Dennis?" This seemed like a simple question indeed to Dennis, but you may have noticed that all questions seem simple if you know the answers, and most horribly difficult if you don't. That Dennis knew the answer to this one was a testament to his honesty and honor, although those traits were so deeply ingrained in his character that he would have been surprised if someone had told him this. He had taken money, Anders Pena's money, in fact, from Ben Stodd to make sure those napkins were delivered. Only a guilder, true, but money was money and pay was pay. He had felt honor-bound to make sure, from time to time, that the service was continuing. He told Pena about the big storeroom. Pena was flabbergasted to hear of it, and how each Saturday night around 7 o'clock, a maid took 21 napkins, shook them, ironed them, folded them, and set them in a stack on a small wheeled cart. This cart stood just inside the room's doorway. Early on Sunday morning, at 6 o'clock, less than 2 hours from right now, a servant boy would pull the cart to the Plaza of the Needle. He would rap at the bolted door at the base of the ugly stone tower, and one of the lesser warders would pull the cart inside and place the napkins on a table, where they would be doled out meal by meal through the week. Pena had been satisfied. Dennis now hurried forward, feeling inside his shirt for the note he had written at the farmhouse. He had a bad moment or two when he couldn't find it, but then his fingers closed over it and he sighed with relief. It had only slipped a little to one side. He lifted the Sunday breakfast napkin. Sunday lunch. For a moment he almost passed over Sunday supper as well, and if he had done that, my tale would have had a very different ending. Better or worse, I cannot say, but surely different. In the end, however, Dennis decided 3 napkins deep was safe enough. He had found a pin in a crack between 2 boards in the farmhouse living room and had nipped it into 1 shoulder strap of the rough linsey camisole he wore as underwear, and if he had been thinking a little better, he would have nipped the note to his underwear with it in the bargain and spared himself that bad moment. But as I may have told you, Dennis's brains were sometimes a little lacking. Now he retrieved the pin and carefully attached the note to an inner fold of the napkin.
"Let it find you, Peter,"
he murmured in the ghostly silence of that storeroom, piled high with napkins made in another age.
"Let it find you, my king."
Dennis knew he must lie low now. The castle would be waking up soon. Stable boys would be stumbling out to the barns. Washerwomen would be moving to the laundries. Cook's apprentices would be stumbling puffy-eyed and sleepy to their fires. Thinking of the kitchens made Dennis's belly rumble anew. By now, even the hateful turnips would have tasted quite nice, but food, he reckoned, would have to wait. He worked his way farther back into the big room. The stacks were so high, the ways so zigzagging and irregular, that it was like working his way into a maze. The napkins gave off a sweet, dry, cottony smell. He finally reached one of the far corners, and here he reckoned he would be safe. He overspilled a stack of the napkins, spread them out, and took another handful for a pillow. It was by far the most luxurious mattress he had ever lain upon, and, hungry as he was, he needed sleep much more than food after his long walk and the frights of the night. He was asleep in no time at all and was troubled by no dreams. We will leave him now, with the first part of his job well and bravely accomplished. We will leave him turned upon his side, right hand curled under his right cheek, sleeping on a bed of royal napkins. And I would like to make a wish for you, listener, that your sleep this night be as sweet and as blameless as his was all that day. '94. On Saturday night, as Dennis was standing in the horror of that wolf's howl and feeling the shade of Flag's thought pass over him, Ben Stodd and Naomi Reachel were encamped in a snowy hollow 30 miles north of Pena's farm, or what had been Pena's farm before Dennis showed up with his story of a king who walked and talked in his sleep. They had made the sort of rough camp people make when they mean to spend only a few hours and then push on. Naomi had seen to her beloved huskies while Ben put up a small tent and built a roaring fire. Shortly, Naomi joined him at the fire and cooked deer meat. They ate in silence, and then Naomi went to check the dogs again. All were sleeping except for Frisky, her favorite. Frisky looked at her with almost human eyes and licked her hand.
"A good pull today, my dear," Naomi said. "Sleep now. Catch a moon rabbit."
Frisky obediently put her head down on her paws. Naomi smiled and went back to the fire. Ben sat before it, his knees pulled up to his chest and his arms around them. His face was somber and thoughtful.
"Snow's coming." "I can read the clouds as well as you, Ben's dad, and the fairies have made a ring around Prince Island's head."
Ben glanced at the moon and nodded. Then he looked back at the fire.
"I'm worried. I've had dreams of, well, dreams of one it's better not to name."
She lit a cigar. She offered the little package, which was wrapped in muslin to prevent drying, to Ben, who shook his head.
"I've had the same dreams, I think," she said.
She tried to make her voice casual, but was betrayed by a slight tremor. He stared around at her, eyes wide.
"I," she said, as if he had asked. "In them, he looks into some bright, glowing thing and speaks Peter's name. I've never been one of your skittish little girls who screeches at the sight of a mouse or a spider in its web, but I waked from that dream wanting to scream aloud."
She looked both ashamed and defiant.
"How many nights have you had it?" "Two."
"I've had it for a running. Mine's just the same as yours. And you needn't look like I'm going to laugh at you or call you Little Nell weeping at the well. I also wake up wanting to scream."
"This bright thing, at the end of my dreams, he seems to blow it out. Is it a candle, do you think?"
"No. You know it's not."
She nodded.
Ben considered. "Something far more dangerous than a candle, I think. I'll take that cigar you offered, if I may."
She gave him one. He lit it from the fire. They sat a while in silence, watching the sparks rise toward the dark wind, which trawled nets of powdery field snow through the sky. Like the light in the dream they'd shared, the sparks blew out. The night seemed very black. Ben could smell snow in that wind. A great deal of snow, he thought. Naomi seemed to read his thought.
"I think such a storm as the old folks tell about may be on the way. What do you think?"
"The same."
With a hesitation utterly unlike her usual forthright manner, Naomi asked,
"What does the dream mean, Ben?"
He shook his head.
"I can't tell. Danger to Peter, that much is clear. If it means anything else, anything I can ken, is that we must hurry."
He looked at her with an urgent directness that made her heart speed up.
"Can we reach Paina's farm tomorrow, do you think?"
"We should be able to. No one but the gods can say that a dog won't break a leg or that a killer bear who can't sleep his winter sleep won't come out of the woods and kill us all, but we should be able to. I exchanged all the dogs I used on the run-up except for Frisky, and Frisky's almost tireless. If the snow comes early, it'll slow us down, but I think it will hold off, and off, and for every hour it does, it'll be that much worse when it finally comes, or so I think. But if it does hold off, and if we take turns jumping off the sledge and running alongside, I think we can make it. But what can we do except sit there unless your friend the butler returns?"
"I don't know."
Ben sighed and rubbed a hand over his face. What good indeed. Whatever it was the dreams foretold, it would happen at the castle, not at the farm. Paina had sent Dennis to the castle, but how did Dennis mean to get in? Ben didn't know, because Dennis hadn't told Paina. And if Dennis did gain entry undetected, where would he hide? There were 1,000 possible places, except...
"Ben."
"What?"
Jerked out of his thoughts, he turned to her.
"What did you think of just now?"
"Nothing."
"Yes, something. Your eyes gleamed."
"Did they? I must have been thinking of pies. It's time you and I turned in. We'll want to be off at first light."
But in the tent, Ben Stodd lay awake long after Naomi had gone to sleep. There were 1,000 places in the castle to hide, yes, but he could think of 2 rather special ones. He thought he might well find Dennis in one or the other. At last he fell asleep and dreamed of Flag.
Peter began that Sunday as he always did with his exercises and a prayer. He had awakened feeling fresh and ready. After a quick look at the sky to gauge the progress of the coming storm, he ate his breakfast. And of course, he used his napkin.
96. By Sunday noon, everyone in Delane had come out of his or her house at least once to look worriedly toward the north. Everyone agreed that the storm, when it came, would be one to tell stories about in later years. The clouds rolling in were a dull gray, the color of wolf pelts. Temperatures rose until the icicles hanging beneath the eaves of the alleys began to drip for the first time in weeks, but the old-timers told each other, and anyone else who would listen, that they were not fooled. The temperature would plummet quickly, and hours later, perhaps two, perhaps four, the snow would begin, and they said it might fall for days. By 3 o'clock that afternoon, those farmers of the inner baronies, fortunate enough to still have livestock to watch out for, had gotten their animals into the barns. The cows went mooing their displeasure. The snow had melted enough for them to crop last fall's dry grasses for the first time in months. Joseph, older, grayer, but still lively enough at 72, saw that all the king's horses were stabled. Presumably there was someone else to take care of all the king's men. Wives took advantage of the mild temperatures to attempt to dry sheets which otherwise simply would have frozen on the lines, and then took them in as the daylight lowered toward an early, storm-colored dark. They were disappointed. Their washing had not dried. There was too much moisture in the air. Animals were skittish. People were nervous. Wise mead housekeepers would not open their doors. They had observed the falling mercury in their barometric glasses, and long experience had taught them that low air pressure makes men quick to fight. Delane battened down for the coming storm, and everyone waited. 97. Ben and Naomi took turns running beside the sledge. They reached the Pena farm at 2 o'clock that Sunday afternoon. At about the same time, Dennis was stirring awake on his mattress of royal napkins, and Peter was beginning his meager lunch. Naomi looked beautiful indeed. The flush of her exercise had colored her tanned cheeks the pretty dusky red of autumn roses. As the sledge pulled into Pena's yard, the dogs barking wildly, she turned her laughing face to Ben.
"A record run by the gods," she cried. "We've made it 4 hours earlier than I would have believed when we left, and not one dog has burst its heart. Aye, Frisky, aye, good dog."
Frisky, a huge black-and-white Anduin husky with gray-green eyes, was at the head of the tether. She was jumping in the air, straining against the traces. Naomi unhooked her and danced with her in the snow. It was a curious waltz, both graceful and barbaric. Dog and mistress seemed to laugh at each other in a powerful shared affection. Some of the other dogs were lying down on their sides now, panting hard, obviously exhausted, but neither Frisky nor Naomi seemed even slightly winded.
"Aye, Frisky, aye, my love. Good dog, you've led a famous chase."
"But for what?" Ben asked glumly. She released Frisky's paws and turned to him, angry. But the dejection on his face robbed her of her anger. He was looking toward the house. She followed his gaze and understood. They were here, yes, but where was here? An empty farmhouse, that was all. What in the world had they come so far and so fast for? The house would have been just as empty an hour, 2 hours, 4 hours from now. Pena and Arlen were in the north, Dennis somewhere in the depths of the castle, or in a prison cell, or a coffin awaiting burial if he had been caught. She went to Ben and put a hesitant hand on his shoulder.
"Don't feel so bad," she said. "We've done all we could do."
"Have we?" he asked. "I wonder." He paused and sighed deeply. He had taken off his knitted cap and his golden hair gleamed mellowly in the dull afternoon light. "I'm sorry, Naomi. I don't mean to snap at you. You and your dogs have done wonders. It's just that I feel we're very far from where we could give any real aid. I feel helpless." She looked at him, sighed, and nodded. "Well," he said, "let's go in. Maybe there'll be some sign of what we're to do next. We'd at least be out of the blow when it comes." There were no clues inside. It was just a big, drafty, empty farmhouse that had been quit in a hurry. Ben prowled restlessly from room to room and found nothing at all. After an hour, he collapsed unhappily beside Naomi in the sitting room, in the very chair where Anders Pena had sat when he listened to Dennis's incredible story. "If only there was a way to track him," Ben said. He looked up to see her staring at him, her eyes bright and round and full of excitement.
"There might be," she said. "If the snow holds off."
"What are you talking about?"
"Frisky!"
she cried.
Don't you see? Frisky can track him. She has the keenest nose of any dog I've ever known.
The scent would be days old, he said, shaking his head. Even the greatest tracking dog that ever lived could not.
Frisky may be the greatest tracking dog that ever lived, Naomi replied, laughing. And tracking in winter's not like tracking in summer, Ben Stad. In summer, trace dies quickly. It rots, Mada says, and there are 100 other traces to cover the one the dog seeks. Not just of other people and other animals, but of grasses and warm winds, even the smells that come on running water. But in the winter, trace lasts. If we had something that belonged to this Dennis, something that carried his scent.
What about the rest of your team? Ben asked.
I should open the shed over there, she pointed at it, and leave my bedroll in it. If I show them where it is and then free them, they'll be able to forage for their own food, rabbits and such, and they'll also know where to come for shelter.
They won't follow us?
Not if they're told not to.
You can do that? He looked at her with some awe.
No,
Naomi said matter-of-factly.
I don't speak dog, nor does Frisky speak human, but she understands it. If I tell Frisky, she'll tell the others. They'll hunt what they need, but they won't range far enough to lose the scent of my bedroll, not with the storm coming. And when it starts, they'll go to shelter. It won't matter if their bellies are hungry or full.
And if we had something that belonged to this boy Dennis, you really believe Frisky could track him?
Aye.
Ben looked at her long and thoughtfully. Dennis had left this farm on Tuesday. It was now Sunday. He didn't believe any scent could last that long. But there was something in the house which would bear Dennis's scent, and perhaps even a fool's errand would be better than only sitting here. It was the pointless sitting more than anything else that grated on him, the hours ahead when things of grave importance might be happening elsewhere while they sat and twiddled their thumbs here. Under other circumstances, the possibility of being snowbound with a girl as beautiful as Naomi would have delighted him, but not while a kingdom might be won and lost 20 miles to the east, and his best friend might be living or dying with only that confounded butler to help him.
"Well?"
she asked eagerly.
"What do you think?"
"I think it's crazy," he said, "but worth a try." She grinned.
"Do we have something with his scent strong upon it?"
"We do," he said, getting up. "Bring your dog in, Naomi, and lead her upstairs to the attic." Although most humans don't know it, scents are like colors to dogs. Faint scents have faint colors, like pastels washed out by time. Clear scents have clear colors. Some dogs have weak noses, and they read scents the way humans with poor eyes see colors, believing this delicate blue may actually be a gray, or that dark brown may actually be a black. Frisky's nose, on the other hand, was like the eyesight of a man with the gaze of a hawk, and the scent in the attic where Dennis had slept was very strong and very clear. It may have helped that Dennis had been some days without a bath. Frisky sniffed the hay, then sniffed the blanket the girl held for her. She scented Arlen upon it, but disregarded the scent. It was weaker and not at all the scent she had found on the hay. Arlen's smell was lemony and tired, and Frisky knew at once that it was the smell of an old man. Dennis's smell was more exciting and vital. To Frisky's nose, it was the electric blue of a summer lightning stroke. She barked to show that she knew this smell and had put it safely away in her library of scents. "All right, good girl," the tall boy said. "Can you follow it?"
"She'll follow it,"
the girl said confidently.
"Let's go."
"It'll be dark in an hour."
"That's so,"
the girl said, and then grinned. When the girl grinned that way, Frisky thought her heart might just burst with love of her.
"But it isn't her eyes that we want, is it?"
The tall boy smiled. "I guess not," he said. "You know, I must be crazy, but I think we're going to pick up these cards and play them."
"Course we are," she said. "Come on, Ben. Let's use what little daylight's left. It'll be dark soon enough."
Frisky, her nose full of that bright blue scent, barked eagerly. 99. Peter's supper came promptly at 6 o'clock that Sunday night. The storm clouds hung heavy over Delane, and the temperature had begun to drop, but the winds hadn't yet begun to blow, and not a snowflake had fallen. On the far side of the plaza, shivering in stolen cook boys' whites,
Dennis stood anxiously, drawn back into the deepest shadow he could find, staring at the single square of pale yellow light at the top of the needle, Peter's candle. Peter, of course, knew nothing of Dennis's vigil. He was filled with the wonder of the idea that, live or die, this would be the last meal he would ever eat in this damned prison cell. It was just more tough, salty meat, half-rotted potatoes and watery ale, but he would eat it all. For the last 3 weeks he had eaten little and had spent all the waking time he did not spend working at the tiny loom, exercising, readying his body. Today, however, he had eaten everything brought to him. He would need all his strength tonight.
What will happen to me? He wondered again, sitting down at the little table and grasping the napkin that lay over his meal. Where exactly will I go? Who will take me in? Anyone? All men, it said, must trust in the gods, but Peter, you are trusting so much it's ridiculous.
Stop. What'll be is what'll be. Now eat and think no more of... But that was where his restless thoughts broke off, because as he shook the napkin out he felt a small stab, like the prick of a nettle. Frowning, he looked down and saw that a tiny bead of blood had seeped up on the ball of his right forefinger. Peter's first thought was a flag. In the fairy tales it was always a needle that bore the poison. Perhaps he had been poisoned now, by Flag. That was his first thought, and not such a silly one at that. After all, Flag had used poison before. Peter picked the napkin up, saw a tiny folded object with black smudgy marks on it, and flipped the napkin back down at once. His face remained calm and peaceful, giving away none of the wild excitement that had burst up inside him at the sight of the note pinned inside the napkin. He glanced casually toward the door, suddenly afraid he would see one of the lesser warders, or Beeson himself, staring suspiciously in at him, but there was no one. The prince had been a great object of curiosity when he first came to the needle, stared at as avidly as a rare fish is stared at in a collector's tank. Some of them had even smuggled their lady loves up to look at the murdering monster, and they would have been imprisoned for it themselves if they had been caught. But Peter was a model prisoner, and he had palled quickly. No one was looking at him now. Peter forced himself to eat his entire meal, although he no longer wanted it. He wanted to take not the slightest chance of rousing suspicions, now more than ever. He had no idea who the note might be from, or what it might say, or why it had aroused such a fever in him. But for a note to come now, only hours before he planned to make his try to escape, seemed an omen. But of what? When his meal was finally eaten, he glanced toward the door again, made sure the spy hole was closed, and walked to his bedroom with his napkin still held casually in one hand, almost as if he had forgotten that he held it at all. In the bedroom he unpinned the note, his hands were trembling so badly he pricked himself again, and unfolded it. It was written closely on both sides in letters which were rusty and a bit childish, but readable enough. His glance went first to the signature, and his eyes widened. The note was signed, Dennis, your friend and servant forever.
Dennis!
Peter muttered, so flabbergasted he was unaware that he had whispered aloud.
Dennis!
He turned back then, and the letter's opening was enough to shock his heartbeat into a fast drum roll. The salutation was, My King. One hundred.
My King, as you may know, for the last 5 years I have battled in service to your brother, Thomas. In just this last week I have found out that you did not murder your father, Roland the Good. I know who did, and Thomas knows as well. You would know the name of this black killer if I dared to write it, but I do not. I went to Pena. Pena has gone to join the exiles with his butler, Orlorn. He has commanded I come to the castle and write to you this note. Pena says that the exiles may soon become rebels, and this must not be. He thinks you may have some sort of plan, but what he knows not. He commands that I be of service to you, and Mada commanded it too before he died, and my heart commands it, for our family has always served the king, and you are the right king. If you have a plan, I will aid you in any way I can, even if it means my death. As you read this, I am across the plaza, in the shadows looking at the needle where you are pent up. If you have a plan,
come, I pray you, and stand at the window. If you have something on which you can write, then throw down a note, and I will try to retrieve it late this night. Wave twice if you will try this idea. Your friend Ben is with the exiles. Pena said he would send him. I know where he, Ben, will be. If you say I should fetch him, Ben, I can in a day, or perhaps two if there is snow. I know that throwing down a note might be risky, but I feel time is short. Pena feels the same way. I will be watching and praying. Dennis, your friend and servant forever.
101. It was a long time before Peter could put his whirling thoughts in order. His mind kept circling back to one question. What had Dennis seen to change his mind so radically and completely? What, in the names of all the gods, could it have been? Little by little he came to realize that it didn't matter. Dennis had seen something, and that was enough. Pena. Dennis had gone to Pena, and Pena had sensed... Well, the old fox had sensed something.
He thinks you may have some sort of plan, but what he knows not.
Old fox, indeed. He had not forgotten Peter's request for the dollhouse and the napkins. He hadn't known exactly what those things meant, but he had sensed something in the wind. Aye, well and truly. Then what was Peter to do? Part of him, a very large part, wanted to go ahead just as he had planned. He had worked his courage up to this desperate adventure. Now it was hard to let it go for nothing but more waiting. And there were the dreams, urging him on as well.
You would know the name of this black killer if I dared to write it, but I do not.
Peter knew just the same, of course, and it was that, more than anything else, that convinced him Dennis really had stumbled onto something. Peter felt that Flagg might soon awake to this new development, and he wanted to be gone before that happened.
Was a day too long to wait?
Perhaps.
Perhaps not.
Peter was torn in an agony of indecision. Ben,
Thomas,
Flagg,
Pena,
Dennis. They whirled in his brain like figures seen in a dream.
What should he do?
In the end, it was the appearance of the note itself, not what was in it, that persuaded him. For it to come this way, pinned to a napkin on the very night he meant to try his rope made of napkins, it meant he should wait, but only for a night. Ben would not be able to help.
Could Dennis help him, though? What could he do?
And suddenly, in a flash of light, an idea came to him. Peter had been sitting on his bed, hunched over the note, his brows furrowed. Now he straightened up, his eyes alight. His eyes fell on the note again.
If you have something on which you can write, then throw down a note, and I will try to retrieve it late this night.
Yes, of course he had something to write on. Not the napkin itself, because it might be missed. Not Dennis's note either, because it was written on both sides from side to side and top to bottom. But Valera's parchment was not. Peter went back into his sitting room. He glanced at the door and saw that the spy hole was closed. Dimly he could hear the warders at cards below. He crossed to the window and waved twice, hoping that Dennis was really out there somewhere and could see him. He would just have to hope so. Peter went back to the bedroom, pulled up the loose stone, and after some reaching and fumbling, retrieved the locket and the parchment. He turned the parchment over to the blank side. But what was he to do for ink? After a moment the answer came to him. The same thing Valera had done, of course. Peter worked at his thin straw mattress, and after some tugging opened a seam. The stuffing was of straw, and before long he had found a number of good long stalks that would serve as pens. Then he opened the locket. It was in the shape of a heart, and the point at the bottom was sharp. Peter closed his eyes for a moment and said a brief prayer. Then he opened them and drew the point of the locket across his wrist. Blood swelled up at once, much more than had come from the pinprick earlier. He dipped the first straw in his blood and began to write. 102. Standing in the cold darkness across the plaza, Dennis saw Peter's shape come to the small window at the top of the needle. He saw Peter raise his arms over his head and cross them twice. There would be a message then. It doubled, No, trebled his risk, but he was glad. He settled in to wait, feeling numbness slowly creep over his feet and kill the feeling in them. The wait seemed very long. The crier called 10, then 11, finally 12 of the clock. The clouds had hidden the moon, but the air seemed strangely light, another sign of a coming storm. He was beginning to think that Peter must have forgotten him, or changed his mind, when that shape came to the window again. Dennis straightened up, wincing at the pain in his neck, which had been cocked upward for the last 4 hours. He thought he saw something arc out, and then Peter's shape left the high window. A moment later the light up there was extinguished. Dennis looked left and right, saw no one, took all of his courage in his hands and ran out into the plaza. He knew perfectly well that there might be someone, a more alert guard of the watch than last night's tuneless singer, for instance, whom he hadn't seen, but there was nothing to be done about that. He was also gruesomely aware of all the men and women who had been beheaded not far from here. What if their ghosts were still around lurking? But thinking about such things did no good, and so he tried to put them from his mind. Of more immediate concern was just finding the thing that Peter had thrown. The area at the foot of the needle below Peter's window was a featureless white snowfield. Feeling horribly exposed, Dennis began to cast about like an inept hunting dog. He wasn't sure what he had seen glimmering in the air. It had been there only for a second, but it had looked solid. That made sense. Peter would not have thrown a piece of paper which might have fluttered anywhere. But what, and where was it? As the seconds ticked by, turning into minutes, Dennis began to feel more and more frantic. He dropped to his hands and knees and began to crawl about, peering into footprints which had melted to the size of dragon prints earlier that day, and which were now refreezing, hard and blue and shiny. Sweat coursed down his face, and he began to be deviled by a recurring idea that a hand would fall on his shoulder, and when he turned he would see the grinning face of the king's magician inside his dark cowl.
A little late for hide-and-seek, isn't it, Dennis?
Flagg would say, and although his grin would widen, his eyes would burn a baleful, hellish red.
What have you lost? Can I help you find it?
Don't think his name. For the gods' sake, don't think his name. But it was hard to stop. Where was it? Oh, where was it? Back and forth Dennis crawled, his hands now as numb as his feet. Back and forth, back and forth. Where was it? Bad enough if he was unable to find it. Worse still if the snow held off until morning light and someone else did. Gods knew what it might say. Dimly, he heard the crier call 1 o'clock. He was now covering ground he had already covered before, becoming more and more panicky.
Stop, Dennis. Stop, boy.
His da's voice too clear in his head to be mistaken. Dennis had been on his hands and knees, his nose almost on the ground. Now he straightened up a little.
You're not seeing anything any more, boy. Stop and close your eyes for a moment, and when you open them, look around. Really look around.
Dennis closed his eyes tight, and then opened them wide. This time he looked around almost casually, scanning the whole snowy tracked area around the foot of the needle. Nothing. Nothing at—
Wait! There! Over there!
Something glimmered. Dennis saw a curve of metal, barely poking half an inch out of the snow. Beside it he could see a round track made by one of his knees. He had almost crawled over the thing during his frantic hunt. He tried to pluck it from the snow, and on his first try only pushed it farther in. His hand was almost too numb to close. Digging in the snow for the metal object, Dennis realized that if his knee had come down on it instead of beside it, he would have driven it more deeply into the snow without even feeling it. His knees were as numb as the rest of him, and then he never would have seen it at all. It would have remained buried until the spring thaws. He touched it, forced his fingers to close, and brought it out. He looked at it wonderingly. It was a locket which might be gold, in the shape of a heart. There was a fine chain attached to it. The locket was shut, but caught in its jaws was a folded piece of paper. Very old paper. Dennis pulled the note free, closed his hand gently over the old paper, and slipped the locket's chain over his head. He got creakily to his feet and ran back toward the shadows. That run was, in a way, the worst part of the whole business for him. He had never felt so exposed in his whole life. For every step he ran, the comforting shadows of the buildings on the far side of the plaza seemed to recede a step. At last he reached comparative safety and stood in the shadows for a while, panting and shuddering. When he had gotten his breath, he returned to the castle, slinking along the fourth alley in the shadows and entering by Cook's Way. There was a guard of the watch at the doorway leading into the castle proper, but he was as sloppy about his duties as his mate had been the night before. Dennis waited, and eventually the guard wandered off. Dennis darted inside. 20 minutes later, he was safely back in the storeroom of the Napkins. Here he unfolded the note and looked at it. One side was closely writ in an archaic hand. The writer had used a strange, rust-colored ink, and Dennis could make nothing of it. He turned the note over and his eyes widened. He recognized the ink that had been used to write the short message on this side easily enough.
"Oh, King Peter," he moaned.
The message was smeared and blurry. The ink had not been blotted, but he could read it. "Meant to try escape tonight. Will wait one night. Dare wait no longer. Don't go for Ben. No time. Too dangerous. I have a rope. Thin. May break. Too short. Will be a drop in any case. 20 feet. Midnight tomorrow. Help me away if you can. Safe place. May be hurt. In the hands of the gods. I love you, my good Dennis. King Peter." Dennis read this note 3 times and then burst into tears. Tears of joy. That light, Pena had sensed, was now shining brightly in Dennis's own heart. That was well, and soon all would be well. His eyes returned again and again to the line, "I love you, my good Dennis," written in the king's own blood. He had not needed to add that for the message to make sense, and yet he had.
"Peter, I would die 1,000 deaths for you," Dennis thought.
He put the note inside his jerkin and lay down with the locket still around his neck. It was a very long time before sleep found him this time, and he had not slept long before he snapped wide awake. The door of the storeroom was opening. The low creak of its hinges seemed an inhuman shriek to Dennis. Before his sleep-fuddled mind even had time to realize he had been found, a dark shadow with burning eyes swept down on him. The snow began at around 3 o'clock that Monday morning. Ben Stodd saw the first flakes go skating past his eyes as he and Naomi stood at the edge of the King's Preserves, looking out toward the castle. Frisky sat on her haunches, panting. The humans were tired, and Frisky was tired as well, but she was eager to go. The scent had grown steadily fresher. She had led them easily from Pena's farm to the deserted house where Dennis had spent some 4 days, eating raw potatoes and thinking sour thoughts about turnips, which turned out to be as sour as the thoughts themselves. In that empty inner barony's farmstead, the bright blue scent she had followed this far had been everywhere. She had barked excitedly, running from room to room, nose down, tail wagging cheerfully.
"Look," Naomi said. "Our Dennis burnt something here."
She was pointing at the fireplace. Ben came and looked, but he could make out nothing. There were only bundles of ash which fell apart when he poked at them. Of course they were Dennis's early tries at his note.
"Now what?" Naomi asked. "He went to the castle from here, that's clear. The question is, do we follow or spend the night here?"
It had then been 6 o'clock. Outside it was already dark.
"I think we had better go on," Ben said slowly. "After all, it was you who said we wanted Frisky's nose, not her eyes, and I, for one, would testify before the throne of any king in creation that Frisky has a noble nose."
Frisky, sitting in the doorway, barked as if to say she knew it.
"All right,"
Naomi said. He looked at her closely. It had been a long run from the camp of the exiles, with little rest for either of them. He knew they should stay, but he was nearly frantic with urgency.
"Can you go on?" he asked. "Don't say you can if you can't, Naomi Rachel."
She put her hands on her hips and looked at him haughtily.
"I could go on 100 kona from the place where you dropped dead, Ben Stodd."
Ben grinned. "You may get your chance to prove it, too," he said. "But first we'll have a bite to eat." They ate quickly. When the meal was finished, Naomi knelt by Frisky and quietly told her that she must take up the scent again. Frisky didn't have to be asked twice. The three of them quit the farmhouse, Ben with a large pack on his back, Naomi with one only slightly smaller. To Frisky, Dennis's scent was a blue mark in the night, as bright as a wire glowing with an electric charge. She began to follow at once, and was confused when the girl called her back. Then it came to her. If Frisky had been human, she would have slapped her forehead and groaned. In her impatience to be off, she had started sniffing up Dennis's back trail. By midnight, she would have had them back at Payna's farmhouse.
"That's all right, Frisky," Naomi said. "Take your time."
"Sure," Ben said. "Take a week or two, Frisky. Take a month if you want."
Naomi cast a sour glance Ben's way. Ben shut up. Prudently, perhaps. The two of them watched Frisky nose back and forth, first across the dooryard of the deserted farm, then across the road.
"Has she lost it?" Ben asked.
"No, she'll pick it up in a minute or two."
"I think," Naomi didn't say aloud.
"It's just that she's found a whole tangle of scents in the road and she has to sort them out."
"Look," Ben said doubtfully. "She's off into the field there. That can't be right, can it?"
"I don't know. Would he have taken the road to the castle?"
Ben Stott was human, and he did slap his forehead.
"No, of course not. I'm a dolt."
Naomi smiled sweetly and said nothing. In the field, Frisky had paused. She turned toward the girl and the tall boy and barked impatiently for them to follow. Anduin huskies were the tame descendants of the great white wolves the residents of the northern barony had feared in earlier times, but tame or not, they were hunters and trackers before they were anything else. Frisky had isolated that bright blue thread of scent again and was in a fever to be off.
"Come on," Ben said. "I just hope she's found the right scent."
"Of course she has. Look."
She pointed, and Ben was just able to make out long, shallow tracks in the snow. Even in the dark, Ben and Naomi knew the tracks for what they were, snowshoes. Frisky barked again.
"Let's hurry," Ben said.
By midnight, as they began to draw close to the king's preserves, Naomi began to regret the crack she'd made about how she could go on 100 kroner from the place where Ben dropped dead, because she had begun to feel as if that might soon happen to her. Dennis had made the trip in better time, but Dennis had set out after 4 days of rest. Dennis had had snowshoes, and Dennis had not been following a dog who sometimes lost the scent and had to cast about for it again. Naomi's legs felt hot and rubbery. Her lungs burned. There was a stitch in her left side. She had taken a few mouthfuls of snow, but they could not slake her raging thirst. Frisky, who was not burdened by a pack and who could run lightly along the snow crust, was not tired at all. Naomi was able to walk on the crust for short distances, but then she would strike a rotten spot and plunge through the crust into soft snow up to her knees, and on several occasions up to her hips. Once she plunged in waist-deep and floundered about in a tired fury until Ben worked his way over and pulled her out.
"Wish... sled," she panted now.
"Wishes, horses, beggars would ride," he panted back, grinning in spite of his own weariness.
"Funny," she gasped. "Ha ha! Ought to be a court jester, Benstad."
"King's preserves up there. Less snow. Easier."
He bent over, hands on his knees, and gasped for breath. Naomi suddenly felt that she had been selfish and unkind, thinking about how she herself felt when Ben must be even closer to the point of exhaustion. He was much heavier than she, especially with the weight of the larger pack he carried added into the bargain. He had been breaking through the snow crust on almost every step, leaping through the long fields like a man running in deep water, and yet he had not complained or slowed.
"Ben, are you all right?"
"No," he wheezed and grinned, "but I'll make it, pretty child."
"I am not a child,"
she said angrily.
"But you are pretty," he said, and put his thumb to the tip of his nose. He wiggled his fingers at her.
"Oh, I'll get you for that."
"Later," he panted. "Race you to the woods. Come on."
So they raced, with Frisky chasing along the scent ahead of them, and he beat her, and that made her madder than ever. But she admired him, too. Now they stood looking across the 70 kroner of open ground, between the edge of the forest where King Roland had once slain a dragon, and the walls of the castle where he had been slain himself. A few more snowflakes skirled down from the sky, and a few more, and suddenly, magically, the air was filled with snow. In spite of his weariness, Ben felt a moment of peace and joy. He looked at Naomi and smiled. She tried a scowl, but it wouldn't fit her face, and so she smiled too. A moment later she ran her tongue out and tried to catch a flake of snow. Ben laughed quietly.
"How did he get inside if he did?" Naomi asked.
"I don't know,"
Ben said. He had grown up on a farm and knew nothing of the castle's sewer system. Probably every bit as well for him, you might say, and you would be right. Perhaps your champion dog can show us how he did it.
You really think he did, don't you, Ben?
Oh, aye, Ben said. What do you think, Frisky?
At the sound of her name, Frisky got up, ranged along the scent for a few feet, and looked back at them. Naomi looked at Ben. Ben shook his head.
Not yet,
he said. Naomi called Frisky softly, and she came back, whining.
If she could talk, she'd tell you she's afraid of losing the scent. The snow will cover it.
We'll not wait long. Dennis had the snowshoes, but we're going to have something he didn't, Naomi.
What's that?
Cover.
105. In spite of Frisky's growing restlessness at being checked on the scent, Ben made them wait 15 minutes. By then the air had become a shifting cloud of white. Snow frosted Naomi's brown hair and his own blonde hair. Frisky wore a cold ermine stole. They could no longer see the castle walls ahead of them.
All right, Ben said softly. Let's go.
They crossed the open ground behind Frisky. The big husky moved slowly now, her nose constantly at the snow, puffing it up every now and again in cold little bursts. The bright blue runner of scent was dimming, being covered by the white, no-smell stuff from the sky.
"We may have waited too long,"
Naomi said quietly beside him. Ben said nothing. He knew it, and the knowledge gnawed at his heart like a rat. Now a dark bulk loomed out of the whiteness, the castle wall. Naomi had moved slightly ahead. Ben reached out and grabbed her arm.
"The moat," he said. "Don't forget that. It's up here somewhere. You'll go over the side and land on the ice and break your neck."
He got just so far, and then Naomi's eyes blazed with alarm. She pulled out of his grip.
"Frisky,"
she hissed.
"Hi, Frisky. Danger. Drop off."
She darted after the dog. "That girl is absolutely giddy bonkers," Ben thought with a certain admiration. Then he darted after her. Naomi needn't have worried. Frisky had stopped at the edge of the moat. Her nose was buried in the snow and her tail was wagging happily. Now she bit down on something and dragged it out of the loose powder. She turned to Naomi, eyes asking, "Now am I a good dog or what? What do you think?" Naomi laughed and hugged her dog. Ben glanced toward the castle wall.
"Hush,"
he whispered at her.
"If the guards hear you, we're in the slate cracker for sure. Where do you think we are? Your back garden." "Pooh! If they heard anything, they'd think it was snow sprites and run for their mommies."
But she whispered too. Then she buried her face in Frisky's fur and told her again what a good dog she was. Ben scratched Frisky's head. Because of the snow, neither of them had the horribly exposed sense Dennis had had when he had sat in the same place, taking off the snowshoes Frisky had now found.
"Nose of the gods, all right," Ben said. "But what happened after he took off the snowshoes, Frisky? Did he grow wings and fly over Western Redan? Where did he go from here?"
As if in answer, Frisky broke away from both of them and went floundering and slipping down the steep bank to the frozen moat.
"Frisky!"
Naomi called, her voice low but alarmed. Frisky only stood on the ice looking up at them, hock-deep in new snow. Her tail was wagging slightly and her eyes begged them to come. She did not bark. Somehow she knew better, even though Naomi had not thought to warn her to silence. But she barked in her mind. The scent was still here, and she wanted to follow it before it disappeared completely, as it now would within minutes. Naomi looked questioningly at Ben.
"Yes,"
he said.
"Of course, we have to. Come on. But keep her to heel. Don't let her range ahead. There's danger here, I feel it."
He held out his hand. Naomi grasped it, and they slid down to the moat together. Frisky led them slowly across the ice toward the castle wall. She was now actually digging for the scent, her nose furrowing the snow. It had begun to be overlaid with a thick, unpleasant smell. Dirty, warm water, garbage, ordure. Dennis had known that the ice would begin to grow dangerously rotten as he got closer to the outflow pipe. Even if he hadn't known, he was able to see the 3 feet or so of open water next to the wall. Things weren't so easy for Ben, Naomi, and Frisky. They had simply assumed that if the ice was thick along the moat's outer bank, it must be thick all the way across, and their eyes were of little use to them in the thickly falling snow. Frisky's eyes were the weakest of the three, and she was in the lead. Her ears were sharp enough, and she had heard the ice groaning beneath the new snow, but the scent was too much on her mind for her to take much notice of the faint creaks, until the ice gave way beneath her and she plunged into the moat with a splash.
"Frisky!"
Ben clapped a hand over her mouth. She struggled to get away from him. Ben had now seen the danger, however, and held her fast. Naomi needn't have worried. Of course all dogs can swim, and with her thick, oily coat, Frisky was safer in the water than either of the humans would have been. She paddled almost to the castle wall amid chunks of rotted ice and whipped cream globs of snow that quickly turned into dark slush and disappeared. She raised her head, smelling, searching for the scent, and when she knew where it went, she turned and paddled back toward Ben and Naomi. She found the edge of the ice. Her paws broke it off, and she tried again. Naomi cried out.
"Be still, Naomi, or you'll have us in the dungeons by dawn," Ben said. "Hold my ankles."
He let her go and then sprawled on his belly. Naomi crouched behind him and seized his boots. This close to the ice, Ben could hear it groaning and muttering.
"It could have been one of us," he thought, "and that would have been trouble indeed."
He spread his legs out a bit to distribute his weight better, and then grabbed Frisky by the forepaws just below her wide, strong chest.
"Here you come, girl,"
Ben grunted.
"I hope."
Then he pulled. For a moment, Ben thought that the ice would just go on breaking under Frisky's weight as he dragged her forward. First he and then Naomi would follow Frisky into the moat. Crossing that moat on his way into the castle to play with his friend Peter on a summer's day, with blue sky and white clouds reflecting off its surface, Ben had always thought it beautiful, like a painting. He had never once suspected that he might die in it one black night during a snowstorm, and it smelled very bad.
"Pull me backward," he grunted. "Your damn dog weighs a ton."
"Don't you say mean things about my dog, Benstad."
Ben's eyes were slitted shut with strain, his lips split open over clenched teeth.
"A million pardons, and if you don't start pulling me, I'm going to be taking a bath, I think."
Somehow she managed to do it, although Ben and Frisky together must have been three times her own weight. Ben's prone, splayed body dug a channel in the new powder, a snow pyramid built up in his crotch, the way it will build up in the angle of a wooden plow. At last. It seemed like at last to Ben and Naomi, although in truth it was probably only a matter of seconds. Frisky's chest stopped breaking the ice and slid onto it. A moment later, her rear paws were digging for purchase. Then she was up and shaking herself vigorously. Dirty moat water sprayed into Ben's face.
"Pah!"
he grimaced, wiping it off.
"Thanks a lot, Frisky."
But Frisky paid no attention. She was looking toward the wall of the castle again. Although the ice was already freezing to her pelt in dirty spicules, the scent was what interested her. She had smelled it clearly, above her but not far above her. There was a darkness there, no cold white no-smell stuff there. Ben was getting to his feet, brushing the snow off.
"I'm sorry I yelled like that,"
Naomi whispered.
"If it had been any other dog but Frisky, do you think I was heard?"
"If you'd been heard, we'd have been challenged,"
Ben whispered back.
"Gods, that was close."
Now they could see the open water just in front of the ancient stone wall of Castle Delane's outer redan, because they were looking for it.
"What do we do?"
"We can't go on,"
Ben whispered.
"That's obvious.
But what did he do, Naomi? Where did he go from here?
Maybe he did fly."
"If we—"
But Naomi never finished the thought, because that was when Frisky took matters into her own paws. All of her ancestors had been famous hunters, and it was in her blood. She had been set upon this exciting, enticing electric blue scent, and she found she could not leave it. So she screwed her haunches down to the ice, tensed her sled-toughened muscles, and leaped into the dark. Her eyes, as I've said, were the least of her sensory equipment, and her leap really was blind. She could not see the dark hole of the sewer pipe from the edge of the ice, but she had seen it from the water. And even if she hadn't, she had her nose, and she knew it was there.
"106. It's Flag,"
Dennis's sleep-fuddled mind thought as that dark shape with the burning eyes swept down on him.
"It's Flag. He's found me, and now he'll rip my throat out with his teeth."
He tried to scream, but no sound came out. The mouth of the intruder did open. Dennis saw huge white teeth, and then a big warm tongue was lapping his face.
"Ugh!"
Dennis said, trying to push the thing away. Paws came up on either shoulder, and Dennis fell back on his mattress of napkins like a pinned wrestler. Lap, lap, lick, lick.
"Ugh!"
Dennis said again, and the dark, shaggy shape uttered a low, companionable woof, as if to say, "I know it. I'm glad to see you, too."
"Frisky,"
a low voice called from the darkness.
"Stand down, Frisky. No sounds."
The dark shape was not Flag at all. It was an extremely large dog, a dog which looked too much like a wolf for comfort, Dennis thought. When the girl spoke, it drew away and sat down. It looked happily at Dennis. Its tail thumped mutedly on Dennis's bed of napkins. Two more shapes in the darkness, one taller than the other. Not Flag, that much was clear. Castle guards, then. Dennis grabbed his dagger. If the gods were good, he might be able to get rid of both of them. If not, then he would try to die well in the service of his king. The two figures had stopped a little short of him.
"Come on,"
Dennis said, and raised his dagger. It was really not much more than a pocket knife and was rather rusty and quite dull. He had a brave gesture.
"First you two, and then your devil dog."
"Dennis?"
The voice was eerily familiar.
"Dennis, have we really found you?"
Dennis started to lower his dagger, then brought it up again. It had to be a trick. Had to be. But the voice sounded so much like...
"Ben,"
he whispered.
"Is it Ben Stodd?"
"It's Ben," the taller shape confirmed, and gladness filled Dennis's heart. The shape began to come forward. Alarmed, Dennis raised his dagger again.
"Wait! Do you have a light?"
"Flint and steel, yes."
"Strike it!"
"Aye."
A moment later, a big yellow spark, surely dangerous in that room filled with dry cotton napkins, flared in the gloom.
"Come forward, Ben,"
Dennis said, reseating his poor excuse for a dagger in its sheath. He got to his feet, trembling with gladness and relief. Ben was here. By what magic, Dennis did not know, only that it had somehow happened. His feet caught in the napkins and he stumbled forward, but there was no danger that he might fall, because Ben's arms swept him up in a strong embrace. Ben was here and all would be well, Dennis thought, and it was all he could do to keep from bursting into unmanly tears. 107. There followed a great exchange of stories. I think you have heard most of them, and the parts you haven't can be told quickly enough. Frisky's leap was a bull's-eye. She carried straight into the pipe and then turned around to see if Naomi and Ben would follow her. If they hadn't done so, Frisky would have eventually leaped back to the ice. She should have been greatly disappointed to do it, but she would not have left her mistress for the most exciting scent in the world. Frisky knew that. Naomi was less sure. She didn't even dare call Frisky back for fear of a guard's overhearing. She therefore intended to go after the dog. She would not leave Frisky, and if Ben tried to make her, she would deck him with a right hook. She needn't have worried. The minute he spotted the pipe, Ben understood where Dennis had gone.
"Noble knows, Frisky,"
he said. He turned to Naomi.
"Can you make it?"
"If I draw back and run, I can make it."
"Don't misjudge where the ice goes rotten, or you'll take a donking, and your heavy clothes will drag you down very quickly."
"I won't misjudge."
"Let me go first," Ben said. "If I have to, maybe I can catch you."
He drew back a few paces and jumped so strongly that he almost took off the top of his head on the upper curve of the pipe. Frisky barked once, excitedly.
"Shut up, dog,"
Ben said. Naomi drew back to the edge of the moat, stood there for a moment. The snow had by then been coming down so heavily that Ben couldn't see her, and then ran forward. Ben held his breath, hoping she wouldn't misjudge the edge of the good ice. If she ran too far before making her leap, the longest arms in the world wouldn't catch her. But she timed it perfectly. Ben didn't need to catch her. All he had to do was to get out of her way as she carried into the pipe. She didn't even bump her head, as Ben had done.
"The worst part of it was the smell,"
Naomi said as they told their story to a wondering Dennis.
"How did you stand it?"
"Well, I just kept reminding myself of what would happen to me if I got caught," Dennis said. "Every time I did that, the air seemed to smell a little better."
Ben laughed at this and nodded, and Dennis looked at him with shining eyes for a moment. Then he looked back at Naomi.
It did smell awfully bad, though, he agreed. I remember that it smelled bad when I was a kid, but not that bad. Maybe a kid doesn't really know how bad a smell is, or something.
I guess that could be, Naomi said.
Frisky was lying on a pile of royal napkins with her muzzle on her paws, her eyes moving from one person to the next as each spoke. She knew very little of what they were saying, but if she had, and if she could have spoken, she would have told Dennis that his perceptions of what made a really bad smell hadn't changed at all since he was a boy. It had been the last dying remainder of the dragon sand they had smelled, of course. The odor had been much stronger to Frisky than to the girl and the tall boy. Dennis's scent had still been there, now mostly in splashes and blobs on the curved walls. These were the places Dennis had touched with his hands. The floor of the pipes was covered with a foul, warm water that had washed away all scent. It was the same bright electric blue. The other scent was a dull, leathery green. Frisky was afraid of it. She knew that some scents could kill, and she knew that not so long ago this had been just such a scent. But it was losing its potency now, and in any case, Dennis's scent led away from the greater concentrations of it. Not too long before they reached the grating Dennis had used to get out of the sewer system, she began to lose the green smell altogether, and Frisky was never in her whole life so happy to lose a smell.
"You met no one? No one at all?"
Dennis asked anxiously.
"No one," Ben said. "I ranged a little bit ahead to keep an eye out. I saw guards several times, but we always had plenty of time to get to some cover before they could see us. In truth, I think we could have come directly here and passed 20 guards and only have been challenged once or twice. Most of them were drunk."
Naomi nodded.
"Guards of the watch," she said. "Drunk! And not drunk out on picket, along the northern borders of some pissy little barony no one ever heard of. Drunk in the castle! Right in the castle!"
Dennis, remembering the toneless, nose-blowing singer, nodded gloomily.
"I suppose we should be glad. If the guard of the watch was now what it was in Roland's day, we'd all be in the needle along with Peter. But I can't be glad somehow."
"I'll tell you this," Ben said in a soft voice. "If I were Thomas, I'd quake in my boots every time I looked north, if such as we saw tonight are all as he has around him."
Naomi looked very troubled at this.
"Pray the gods it never comes to that," she said.
Ben nodded. Dennis reached out and stroked Frisky's head.
"Followed me all the way from Paynes, did you? What a smart dog you are, eh?"
Frisky thumped her tail happily. Naomi said,
"I would hear this story of the sleepwalking king, Dennis, if you would tell it again."
So Dennis told his story, much as he told it to Pena and as I have told it to you, and they listened as spellbound as children hearing the tale of the talking wolf in the Gammer's nightcap. CHAPTER 108 By the time he had finished, it was 7 o'clock. Outside, a dim gray glow had come over Delane. That clotted stormlight was as bright at 7 as it would be at noon, for the greatest storm of that winter, and perhaps the greatest in history, had come to Delane. The wind howled around the eaves of the castle like a tribe of banshees. Even down here the fugitives could hear it. Frisky raised her head and whined uneasily.
"What do we do now?"
Dennis asked. Ben, who had gone over Peter's brief note again and again, said,
"Until tonight, nothing. The castle's awake by now, and there's no way we could get out of here without being seen under any circumstances. We sleep, get our strength back, and tonight, before midnight—"
Ben spoke briefly. Naomi grinned. Dennis's eyes grew bright with excitement.
"Yes," Dennis said. "By the gods, you're a genius, Ben!" "Please, I wouldn't go that far," Naomi said,
but by then her grin was so broad it seemed in danger of splitting her head in two. She reached over, put her arms around Ben, and kissed him soundly. Ben turned an absolutely alarming shade of red. He looked as if he might be on the verge of bursting his brains, as they said in Delane in those long-ago days. I must tell you, though, that he also looked delighted.
"Will Frisky help us?" Ben asked when he got his breath back.
At the sound of her name, Frisky looked up again.
"Of course she will, but we'll need—"
They discussed this new plan for some time longer, and then Ben's lower face seemed to almost disappear in a great yawn. Naomi also looked tired out. They had been awake for over 24 hours by then, you will remember, and had come a great distance.
"Enough," Ben said. "It's time for sleep.
Hooray,
Naomi said, beginning to arrange more napkins in a mattress for herself beside Frisky.
My legs feel as if...
Dennis cleared his throat politely.
What is it?
Ben asked. Dennis looked at their packs, Ben's big one, Naomi's slightly smaller one.
I don't suppose you've got, anything to eat in there, do you?
Impatiently, Naomi said,
Of course we do. What do you think?
Then she remembered that Dennis had left Payne's farmhouse 6 days ago, and that the butler had been skulking and hiding ever since. He had a pallid, undernourished look, and his face was too narrow and too bony.
Oh, Dennis, I'm sorry. We're idiots. When did you eat last?
Dennis thought about this.
I can't remember exactly,
he said,
but the last sit-down meal I had was my lunch a week ago.
Why didn't you say so first thing, you dolt?
Ben exclaimed.
I guess because I was so excited to see you,
Dennis said and grinned, as he watched the two of them open their packs and begin rooting through the remainder of their supplies. His stomach gurgled noisily, saliva squirted into his mouth. Then a thought struck him.
You didn't bring any turnips, did you?
Naomi turned to look at him, puzzled.
Turnips? I don't have any, do you, Ben?
No.
A gentle and supremely happy smile spread across Dennis's face.
Good,
he said. That was a mighty storm indeed, and it's still told of in Delane today. 5 feet of new snow had fallen by the time an early, howling dark came down on the castle keep. 5 feet of new snow in one day is mighty enough, but the wind made drifts that were much, much bigger. By the time dark fell, the wind was no longer blowing a four-scale, it was blowing a hurricane. In places along the castle walls, snow was piled 25 feet deep and covered the windows of not just first and second floors, but the third-floor windows as well. You might think this would have been good for Peter's escape plans, and it might have been if the needle hadn't stood all alone in the plaza, but it did, and here the wind blew its hardest. A strong man couldn't have stood against that wind. He would have been sent rolling head over heels until he crashed against the first stone wall on the far side of the plaza, and the wind had another effect as well. It was like a giant broom. As fast as the snow fell, the wind blew it out of the plaza. By dark, there were huge drifts piled against the castle and clogging most of the alleys on the west side of the castle keep, but the plaza itself was clean as a whistle. There were only the frozen cobbles waiting to break Peter's bones if his rope should break. And I must tell you now that Peter's rope was bound to break. When he tested it, it had held his weight, but there was one fact about that mystic thing called breaking strain that Peter didn't know. Joseph hadn't known either. The ox drivers knew it, though, and if Peter had asked them, they would have told him an old axiom.